Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Boredom appears to be part and parcel of the human experience. We've got potent minds. They're not always happily engaged. We get bored. For most of history, people have complained about that. Today, maybe we could use a little more boredom, or maybe not. This hour on Point, a lively history of boredom. You can join the conversation. Do you hate boredom or crave a little bit of it in our frenetic time? What do you say when the kids say, "I'm so bored"? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll get perspective on long, maybe boring movies from the New York Times movie critic A.O. Scott, and on boredom and daydreaming from science writer Jonah Lehrer. But first, joining me from Alberta, Canada, is Peter Tui, professor of classics at the University of Calgary. His new book is Boredom, A Lively History. Peter Tui, welcome to the show.
G'day, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
G'day, sir. Lovely to have you. What is boredom?
Well, there seems to be two sorts of boredom. There's the boredom that you're used to from your children, or sadly enough, often your old folks. And the way I'd describe that sort of boredom, which I call simple boredom, is something that's mildly disgusting. That's why we say I'm fed up, I guess. So mild disgusting, and it's produced by circumstances that are temporarily unavoidable and that are predictable. So that's one of the two sorts of boredoms. The other one is what's called existential boredom, and it's the sort of thing you tend to read about in books a lot. Jean-Paul Sartre or Camus and so on. It's a sense of an unrelieved sense of emptiness, of isolation, where a person feels a lack of interest, almost difficulty in concentrating on their current interests. So they're the two sorts.
You're a classicist, so take us back to the time of the classics or back in that direction. I mean, have humans always wrestled with boredom? Do you think they were more bored in the past? What's the evidence that, I don't know, the ancient Greeks or ancient Romans wrestled with boredom?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that people really wrestle with it. I suppose we do, because we're conscious of it because of, particularly with our children. The Greeks and the Romans ignored it to a large degree, as far as I can tell. And the reason for that is that I suspect they thought it was a trivial emotion. There is some evidence, however, that the Greeks and the Romans dealt with the emotion. And there's a not so, I'd like it to be a famous inscription, but it's what the inscription says is that it's written for a man called Tenonius Marcellinus, and it's from the town of Beneventum, or Benevento in the modern parlance. And it thanks the man for saving the town from everlasting. Well, I don't think it says everlasting, but it saves the town from boredom. They put up a rock inscription for him for doing this, which is extraordinary, isn't it?
What do you think that means? That he threw a lot of bread and circus at the town? That he had tigers and elephants in the streets?
Something like the second one. I suspect it was gladiatorial games. Most towns had it, and I think he probably put on a lot of games for them, and that broke up the tedium. I imagine that life in their small provincial towns in the ancient world, where you were away from the central places like Rome and so on, was unchanging and excruciatingly boring. This is my guess.
You've got different words, different nuances around boredom. Monks, early Christians in the desert, feeling when they were, I suppose, looking for revelation or ecstasy, sometimes found something quite contrary to that. What do they call that?
Well, the demon at noontide's one of the names, or a more technical name, which is Acedia. Which means a state of almost indifference, the word means, but it's more virulent than that. I think you've got to imagine the circumstances to get a sense of it, that you imagine a fairly smallish mountain, fairly rocky, and it's well south of Alexandria in the desert, and you've got individuals setting up camp, as it were, in the caves in the mountain. So we're not looking at a monastery. We're looking at a group of monks living in the desert in caves, mostly in silence, praying. Now, the demon seems to have hit them mostly shortly after lunchtime, which is pretty much when it hits me too, I think. It's at that point that they despair of their, or perhaps it wasn't as strong as despair, they'd become fed up with their vocation. They'd be tempted to leave their little caves full of bugs, snakes, and so on and so forth, and to look for greener pastures. And in doing so, I suppose they were tempted to despair of the beneficence of God. So they called this Acadia, and it had a long, long history in religious literature. It's often linked with a despair in the beneficence of God and so on and so forth. But in the case of the Acadia we're talking about, it really seems to me like it's a product of the circumstances. As I say, imagine yourself in one of these caves, very little food, no one to talk to, but the odd snake and the odd bed bug and so on. It'd be enough to drive anybody to acute boredom.
You offer us a lot of examples of the apparent presentation of boredom from arts and photography. And you got everything in your book from Victoria Beckham with her kind of impassive face to Degas and Hopper and right across the span of time in the arts. How do you know when you look at a piece of art whether the artist is conveying tranquility or peace or, calm meditation versus boredom?
Well, I think there are certain types of signals that are sent from these pictures, and maybe the really simplest is that the very texture of paintings that seem to deal with boredom is flat. It's not bumpy. It doesn't stand out from the surface. So flat surfaces in the actual texture and the scope of the painting itself. And then there are often squares, as it were. So you're liable to have windows, door frames, the boards that you would use for picture hangers and so on. There's also a tendency, and here I really am stretching it, but it seems like, what the heck? I'm in a room on my own. I can say this. No one will hear me.
Oh, they will.
the colour is often a colour of a limeish colour, a bilious lime, or a brown, a slightly nauseous fawn. Now, that's really stretching it, but as I say, the colours seem to match, and why I'm interested in those colours fitting is that behind all this is this sense of disgust. If boredom is an emotion, it's an emotion that's a first cousin of disgust itself, hence this notion of I'm fed up. So there we've got colours, we've got flatness, squares in the picture itself, but there's also certain types of gestures that you'd link with it.
The hands, the face sunk in the hand, or the
exactly, yeah.
Or hands on hips just kind of thrust forward like, oh boy, nothing to do but sway here.
Yeah, exactly. And the hands on hips are a posture of disgust too, aren't they? If you're really fed up with somebody you're working with, and there's that word fed up again, you're liable to put your hands on your hips and almost thrust them at him. So,
but what is it with this disgust? Disgust with when it's boredom? Disgust with what? Disgust with the lack of stimulation, the lack of engagement? Disgust with what?
I think something like that, or the disgust. The word they often link it with is satiety, having had too much of something, hence fed up. So that. Just, if you ever had a lot of a particular type of meal that you like, I'm very fond of baklava. I tend to eat too much of it,
oh,
or
dear.
Rumbles.
Yeah.
I know, you eat too much of it, and the feeling is one of mild disgust if you've had too much of it, and you've got to knock off for a day or so, don't you?
But then I feel a little bit sick. Mm. Here you're calling boredom an emotion. I'd never quite thought of it as an emotion, but I'm warming to that. But you, more than that, you call it, in Darwinian terms, you call it an adaptive emotion. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think emotions of their own selves are adaptive. Disgust's a good one, seeing where we're on that theme, that if I were to put a plate of food in front of you and say, try this, Tom, and you looked at it, and it was mouldering and smelt, you would feel disgust, would you not?
I suppose. And hope so.
Well, I hope so too. It's the disgust is designed adaptively in a Darwinian sense, is it not, to drive you away from that plate of food.
So what's boredom to drive us from then?
Well, I think what boredom's designed to do is to drive us away from situations that can be injurious to us. Now, it's not so simple now, is it, that a person might be bored listening to me now, for example, but it's probably not going to do them very much harm. But you imagine that you're incarcerated, a human being or a dog, if the initial response to a situation like that is going to be boredom, is it not? You would hope that.
So what, it teaches us not to break the law, so we're not incarcerated again? Is that a Darwinian adaptation?
Well, I think something very close to that, that what's going to follow from the boredom is going to be a angry reaction. And this sort of process has been replicated by people who observe animals in captivity. So initially, the manic reaction, or the angry reaction, shows itself in this sort of pacing, tail swinging, and repetitive motions that you'll see with animals in zoos.
Nothing ever happens. Nothing happens at all. The needle returns to the start of the song, and we all sing along like before. And we'll all be lonely tonight and lonely tomorrow.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour, of all things, about boredom, its history, its value, and why we may need a little boredom these days. My guest is Professor Peter Tuohy, University of Calgary, joins us today from Calgary in Alberta, Canada. His new book is Boredom, A Lively History. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Professor Tuohy, we have a lot of unbored reaction here, and there's no small amount of it online. Here's an example from Mike. He says, if you are bored, you are boring. He says there's too much at our disposal in the 21st century for us ever to be bored. What do you say to that?
People say it a lot, don't they? If you're bored, you're accused of being boring. But if I'm right and boredom is an emotion, well, would you ever say that anger is boring? You might say it's too much of it is a bad thing, but emotions are there for a purpose, aren't they? Love might be an emotion. It's there to help you to get married.
But Mike be one of those who says it's just a lack of imagination. It's a lack of mental initiative. It's a lack, a failure to perceive all the things of interest around one.
I think I have some sympathy with the statement, but it's always made from a position of privilege, isn't it? To think about an old folks' home. Now, I'm not so familiar with them in the U.S., but I've seen enough of them in my native Australia and here in Canada. You take a person who is frail and can't look after themselves and put them into an old age home. Put them in the TV room with the wilting flowers, with the people who are beginning to be demented or are demented. And I've watched relatives of mine put into these places, well, mostly not relatives. And within 2 weeks, they're aping the same symptoms.
Yes, I take your point. I'm sure anybody would, but that seems to you seem to take it to the extreme to make the point. I mean, here's Angela says on Facebook, I know, she says when her kids tell her, that they're bored, she tells them there's no such thing as boredom, only lack of imagination. Now, all right, incarcerated people and folks in old folks' home, those are tough, and exempting those, what about the case? It's just a lack of imagination.
Well, let's get to school then now, where kids spend the ages of 5 through to 18, and they spend 6 to 7 hours a day. And I don't know about you, but I was pretty bored at school. Mind you, I've stuck around, haven't I, for all these years.
Yes, you have. Okay, let's accept school. Let's accept school. Here's Alexis writes on Facebook. She writes, I haven't been bored in years. All uppercase. I haven't been bored in years. I've been bored in years, sir.
So we've got old folks now. We've got kids at school.
But not Alexis. She's not any of those. And maybe she's in the camp that says boredom is.
Well, she might be lucky, and she has a really interesting job, like you and I do. Do you never get bored with your work? I think most people actually do an awful lot.
Honestly, I don't really have the option, and in truth, I don't. I was thinking about this. It has been a long time since since I was bored in a way that I recall. I remember some boring afternoons as a child now and then, you know, long, hot summer afternoons when for one reason or another there wasn't that much going on. Interestingly, I look back on those now, you know, there's a certain kind of lusciousness that can come along with that kind of lazy boredom. I look back on that kind of fondly now. Do you?
Yes, I agree with you that there is a pleasure in looking back. I think, though, we're letting work off the hook too easily when we do that. That I remember when I was a student, I worked one summer in an ice cream factory, and I think that it was probably the most boring task that I ever have ever had. That my hair stuck to the ice cream. God forbid! This is when the hat would fall off.
Oh dear.
The smell of the machines when you had to wash them down at about 12 o'clock in the evening when you're finished, of the melting ice cream and so on, has stuck with me to this day. I can eat ice cream again now, but a lot of people work in jobs like that all the time, and I think it's wrong of us to underestimate the extent to which an awful lot of work, a lot of toil, is boring. So I think we've got another one in there. We're building up the picture here.
yes, you are. Yes, you're building in the pieces. Though, didn't William Faulkner kind of daydream about his novels and go home and write them after work? We're not all Faulkners, are we?
That's half the problem, isn't it? It's pretty hard. And I write a little bit as part of my living, but I find it very hard to do it without a pen in my hand, and I know a lot of people feel that. So Faulkner's very lucky to have that sort of capacious brain that he can think things through and carry them with him, but for an awful lot of us, you've got to be in front of a keyboard or have a pen and some paper with you to actually do that sort of thing.
Peter, let me go to our phones, if I may, because we've got people who are not bored by your conversation calling in, and a fair number. The new book is Boredom, A Lively History. Melody is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Melody, you're on the air.
Hi. I heard that comment that someone said that it's impossible to be bored nowadays, and I actually disagree because...
When are you bored?
You know, I'm bored when it's a beautiful day outside, I really want to hang out with friends, and no one is around to do anything, and I'm just stuck at home in front of the television. But I think that being stuck at home is in front of the TV is different than, you know, having a really long day at work, coming home, wanting to relax, and, you know, sitting in front of the television. To me, that's not boredom. That's relaxation.
So people might say, how old are you, Melody, if I may ask?
19.
So you're 19. So you've got like a zillion things that are always available, presumably more or less online, you know, Facebook, you name it. Is that an antidote to boredom, or can you be bored even there?
That is absolutely not an antidote to boredom because, you know, one of the funny things about Facebook is that when you're bored, you just kind of keep clicking refresh without ever doing anything on Facebook, waiting for your friends to say something. But all your friends are bored too, and so they're doing the exact same thing. And I think that boredom Facebook is just a complete waste of time when you're bored because it doesn't help the problem.
Everybody's sitting around clicking refresh but not feeling refreshed, Melody.
Exactly.
I appreciate your call. That's great. Thanks so much. Let me get one more. Bob in Burlington, Vermont. Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right.
I don't know if this qualifies as boredom or not, but I want to tell you two things. A few years back, my ex-wife said to me, we were talking about something, and I said that I'm a contemplative person, and she made one of these stifled laughter sounds. And next time I spoke to her, I said, well, how many people do you know who in the last 10 years have written two screenplays and a novel? I didn't tell either one, but, you know.
Okay,
The other thing was we used to have a restaurant, a locally famous restaurant, and for some reason or other, and this has happened to me a number of times, and I consider it kind of a eureka moment, the words lemon and ginger went in my mind, and we came out with a ginger lemonade, which sold a ton. I mean, you see it everywhere now, but as far as I know, we were the first. And that came while I was staring at some movie, probably, you know? So I don't know if the professor would consider that boredom.
So you see an upside to boredom. An upside here, what, in creativity. Ginger lemonade comes out of a long afternoon with a maybe boring, I don't know, movie. Bob, I appreciate your call, and I'm still contemplating your ex-wife being ex after calling you contemplative. Is contemplative the same thing, Peter Tuohy, as being contemplative the same thing as being bored? I wouldn't think so.
I think it might be boring for the person you're with, though, mightn't it? Depends on them. Contemplative people look inwards, don't they? And a lot of people take their stimulus from things around them, don't they? It's very hard to mix the two sorts of characters. If you're a contemplative person with a person who looks outwards for their enjoyment rather than inwards, you're going to be a bad mix. And there's going to be trouble. So maybe Bob was in a situation like that.
What about the idea that we need some boredom these days? Your Corey writes online, says, I prefer some of the aliases of boredom. Peace and quiet, calm, tranquil, private. And then he quotes the singer John Mayer a lyric saying, nothing to do, nowhere to be, a perfect little kind of free. I think people can relate to that.
Sure. It works if you're very busy, doesn't it? Because there's the downtime. It's almost like taking a holiday in between. But too much free time or too much predictability is going to bring the boredom back with a vengeance.
Peter Tuohy, stand by there in Calgary, if you would. We're joined right now from New York City by A.O. Scott, chief film critic for The New York Times. He recently wrote an article, co-wrote with Manola Dargis, called In Defense of the Slow and Boring in Films. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. A.O. Scott, Tony Scott, thanks for being with us.
Always good to be here. How are you?
We're well. I mean, you write about what people might call long, boring movies, and you write in defense of them. What's the defense?
Well, the defense, I think, is more against the idea that these movies are boring in some intrinsic way.
Mm-hmm.
And that to describe and dismiss certain films, you know, Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris or the recent movie Meek's Cut Off, are movies that are slow and difficult and not, you know, continuously stimulating and exciting as boring is to mistake one's own response for some quality of these things itself. And I think that I don't like boring movies, but I do like quite a few movies that might be seen that way, that are slow, that don't explain themselves at every moment to the viewer, that mm-hmm. give you some room to think and to interpret and to be absorbed in an experience.
You know, I was planted on a transcontinental flight just a couple of weeks ago and ended up in front of a Vietnamese movie. I doubt I ever would have seen it otherwise, but it was called Adrift. And it was summer in Hanoi, I think, and this movie was a very, very, very slow-moving movie. If I hadn't been locked into that seat, I don't know if I would have stuck with it, but I did because there I was in my seatbelt, you know, at 30,000 feet. And it ended up being quite fantastic. Something in me slowed down as well and began to perceive wavelengths and, I don't know, nuance that I would have missed otherwise, Tony, if
I... I think that's a very important point that you raised. There are several movies I can think of that are like that. One is a notoriously long and rarely seen movie, Jacques Rivette's Out One, which was made for French television, which it goes something like, I think, 15 hours is the total viewing experience. And I remember seeing that in a screening at a museum, which was over the course of 2 days, doing nothing but watch this movie. And it started out excruciating, unbearable. And after about 3 or 4 hours, it really got going and, you know, became its own reality and an experience that I certainly wouldn't have traded for anything. And certainly not for the kind of movies that I think really are boring, which are a lot of the hyped up, hysterical, overdone action movies that are meant to be exciting and thrilling and stimulating, but give you actually nothing to think about, nothing to experience, don't take you out of yourself, and leave you with a kind of grinding tedium, I often find, of being bullied into having a good time, even if you're not.
We're talking with A.O. Scott of the New York Times and Peter Tuohy at the University of Calgary about boredom. Tony Scott, so what about you? When are you bored these days? Is it you know, stuck in a screening of a bad movie, or is life so hopping these days that there's no boredom for Tony Scott?
Well, I think I do get bored when I'm stuck in a bad movie, but which is not to say a slow-moving or difficult movie. Mm-hmm. I sometimes find that a movie like Meek's Cut Off, which is extremely deliberate in its pacing, it's not that long, but it not a whole lot happens in it. It's a kind of a Western made by Kelly Reichardt, starring Michelle Williams. I find that being forced to slow down in a daily life that's dominated by newspaper deadlines, by Twitter, by email, by the proliferation of screens and stimuli in my life, that I'm least bored when I'm forced to pay attention to something, whether I'm, reading a book somewhere where I'm not getting cell phone reception, or sitting in a movie that is demanding my full attention. Where I'm most bored, I think, is in movies that sort of pander to this idea that I'm like a child who needs stimulus all the time. So I find a movie like Thor or The Hangover 2 to be extremely boring in the active sense, almost as if I'm being sort of slowly pierced by a dull blade.
Well, please don't assume that you're a twitchy child. Tony, Peter, let me get a call. Joseph in Acton, Massachusetts. Joseph, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I had a question, actually.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs?
Yes.
Yes. I was wondering if it was just a thought I had. If someone is self-actualized, they can't really be bored. They maybe when they are bored or something, they might reflect upon themselves or appreciate something which one might not normally appreciate. Somebody who isn't self-actualized.
I love the question, Peter Tui. What about it? You describe boredom as a path to maybe self-perception because it turns us in on ourselves. But if someone is self-actualized, I don't know if they've fully realized living Buddha. Maybe they're never bored, Peter.
I think I don't know about the never being bored, but the idea that boredom gives you a chance to look at yourself makes a lot of common sense, I think, doesn't it? The whole notion of boredom is it's almost a standing away from yourself and the experience, the situation you're in. It does provide an opportunity for getting some sort of a grip on who you are, the way you do things and so on. Perhaps if it lasts long enough and if you can embrace the experience, which isn't always easy, is it? But I think, nonetheless, boredom and creativity run hand in glove.
Tony Scott, what about it? Can you imagine yourself being so fully realized as a human being that nothing could bore you? There's always some, higher thought on your mind.
Well, I think someone has said, I think I don't remember who, that to be bored is to lack inner resources. And I think there's some of that, but I guess I would want to distinguish between types of experiences that produce different things that look like boredom. So, you can be listening to a very slow piece of music or reading something that kind of puts you into a state of calm, tranquil contemplativeness. But you can also be bored by things that are empty and meaningless and repetitive, So I don't know if I'm self-actualized enough to, let's say, transcend the experience of waiting online at the Department of Motor Vehicles for a license renewal or
that takes a very high level of actualization, I guess.
Yes, exactly.
A.O. Scott with the New York Times, you're a great sport to be with us for a minute today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Fire
hooks on tender hooks for me. Sherman Billingsley even cooks for me. Monotonous. I could not be with you. Life could not be dreamier if I lived in Siberia.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour, of all things, about boredom, its history, its value, and why we may need a little boredom these days. My guest is Peter Tui. He's author of the new book, Boredom, A Lively History. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us today. What has boredom changed your life in a job, in a marriage? Did it lead you to change your life? And what's your reaction when your kids say, I'm so bored? What's the redeeming side, if you see one, of boredom. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Lots of feedback online here. Loring says, to know myself through meditation and contemplation has relieved me from ever being bored. Anne writes, remember the lazy, boring days of the summers of our youth. We used to get a certain amount of inactive brain time to dream and come up with ideas. In today's society, people are not allowed to be bored, and parents have a hard time withstanding their children's pleas of boredom. We have filled all the empty spaces in our lives. Sounds like a plea for some of those. 800-423-8255. Here's a question for you, Professor Tuohy, from Charlie Henley. He says, what are your thoughts on the relationship between boredom and depression? What about it, Professor Tuohy?
They always seem to run hand in glove. It seems to me that we were talking a little bit earlier about incarcerated animals, incarcerated human mm-hmm. beings. The steps seem to be boredom, an angry reaction to that. And then when that proves useless, the reaction is one of depression. So it's as if you've got a wheel or a cycle that boredom can cycle through anger and depression, and if circumstances relieve, perhaps back to boredom again. So they're certainly linked. The sort of existential boredom which we talked about right at the beginning,
yes,
which is a emptiness and isolation, it's probably doing a disfavor to the many, many people who've written books about existential boredom to say that it sounds to me like depression, but, well, it certainly does. So, yes, there's a strong link between the two.
But here's the other side, Anne saying, please give me some more empty spaces in life where we can let our minds float free and be creative.
Absolutely. There's the link between boredom and daydreaming daydreaming is an antidote to boredom is a very strong one, and I sympathize exactly with what she said, because what is it? Ginger lemonade comes out of boredom,
right.
Does it not?
Right. Or an antidote to boredom or a product of boredom. I don't know. In a moment, we'll go to Jonah Lehrer, who's going to join us from Los Angeles. Let me get a call first from Nashville, if I may. Nashville, Tennessee. And Eliza. Hi, Eliza. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, Tom.
Yes.
I think it's such an important subject, and I just see boredom as the key to any real creativity. If you could say that, reality is really kind of an agreement among 7 billion people on the planet, and that the way to really create a new meaning or a new way of living is really through boredom. And forgive me, I get huge stage fright on the radio.
Oh, no, I think it's a great point, and I'm glad you're making it. But how do you then actively seek boredom in order to somehow, you know, float through it to something valuable on the other side? Or is it really boredom if you're engaged in some kind of inspiring contemplation, Eliza?
Well, no, Mr. Professor Tuohy was saying he thought of boring as disgust, but I think of more of it as dissatisfaction. And I'm very illiterate about movies, but one of the main reasons is I'm so bored by what passes for entertainment. That makes me despair. I just think if this is what I'm supposed to have in common with people, I want out. So I do spend a lot of time alone because I'm frustrated and really baffled by what's offered as entertainment. And I am a painter, and I do read a lot. And I'm sorry if I'm bouncing around.
I relate entirely, you know, that sense of 700 channels these days and nothing on. I find myself floating away very often from that kind of media. On the other hand, at least in my case, I've got an appetite for those empty spaces, for a different kind of boredom, which is awfully enticing these days when there's nothing one has to think about, or you know, no sort of pop culture stream in which one has to be bounced around, Eliza.
Oh, that's when I feel despair, really, is when I'm confronted with what other people accept. That really makes me feel alone. But because of the aloneness, I do read a lot. And one of the things, because I don't really see very many movies at all, but a writer who comes to mind who's so often accused of being boring is Henry James. And once you're able to read that language and hear it the way you hear language now, he's hilarious, for one thing. He's very, very funny, and I don't find him boring. And I'm reading now for the third time this year, I'm reading Infinite Jest, and people have even accused David Foster Wallace of being boring. And I think that book could be put in a time capsule or it could be launched into outer space. And if people, again, could interpret the language, they would know. They would know our time in America. They would.
Eliza, I'm so glad for your call. You do have a big appetite, third time through Infinite Jest. But I understand that. And, you know, it's interesting, Peter Tuohy, there may be a definitional thing here around boredom. A.O. Scott is bored with the sort of, you know, fast chatter of modern life. But we may actually have an appetite these days for the sort of empty spaces that might have been considered boring, I don't know, 500 years
ago. Listening to A.O. Scott, the definition of dull or the definition of activity was all about predictability and the fact that you can't get away from them, which was part of my definition of boredom in the first place. So it's the boredom is the busyness, is it not? The empty space that we're sort of trying to label as boring is not in fact boring. Here's the downtime, the relaxing from the boring reality of Thor or Hangover 2, as he felt, and so on.
Let me bring Jonah Lehrer into our conversation, if I may. He joins us from Los Angeles, science writer, contributing editor at Wired, Radiolab, and Scientific American Mind, author of How We Decide, and Proust Was a Neuroscientist. Jonah Lehrer, great to have you. Thanks for joining us for a minute today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what do you think about boredom? Do you do anything to avoid it? Is there something in it you might embrace? Is there a payoff from boredom?
Well, one thing I've really tried to do in my own life is to let myself be a little bit bored. Because when you look at the neuroscience of boredom, as you guys have been talking about, it really is a precursor to daydreaming. When we're bored, we very quickly fall down this rabbit hole built into our mind in which we start to daydream. I think in the last few years, there's been a lot of research into what happens in the brain when we daydream. It really turns out to be this astonishing mental feat. We consume just as much energy in our brain when we're daydreaming as when we're intensely focused on something. And I think scientists have also, this is primarily the work of Jonathan Schooler at UCSB, have also really begun to discover this link between people who do really well on tests of creativity and people who daydream a lot. That there does seem to be a real connection between daydreaming and coming up with new ideas.
So do we have to be unhooked from the nonstop parade of stimulation in order to have the boredom that frees the daydreaming, or, you know, can we do it even in the midst of that shower?
When you talk to the scientists, people like Jonathan Schooler, I mean, he now takes what he calls a dedicated daydreaming walk every day, where he goes on the beach, leaves his iPhone behind, and just lets his mind wander. And he says that's where all his best ideas come from, you know, when he is untethered from this constant stream of information. And I personally think that's why so many people have the anecdotes of our best ideas coming in the shower. Because when we think about it, those are the 5 minutes a day when we're not actually checking Twitter and Facebook and our email, and we're finally able to lapse into a good long daydream.
But the circuit breaker here may be that I fear Peter Tuohy will say, well, if you're out on a walk or in the shower and you're having a lovely interior, you know, sort of dialogue, that's not boring. You're not bored.
Well, this is how the brain reacts to the vacuum of boredom, is we very quickly lapse into a daydream. It's actually called the default network. When we're daydreaming, we daydream so much that it's actually called the default network because it's what we lapse into by default. And I think our problem now is we've got computers in our pockets, and so as soon as we even detect the trace of boredom, we just get out our phone, our BlackBerry, our whatever, and start, you know, tapping back into that stream of information floating all around us. So we never really let ourselves fall into a luxurious daydream. And he was beginning to discover now that, that daydreaming turns out to be this essential mental habit, that there's a reason, a very good reason, why we daydream so naturally and automatically, that it's great for creativity. We explore lots of social counterfactuals, so we think about what would have happened if we'd done something mm-hmm. else, and that's a big part of social intelligence. So people who don't daydream enough turn out to have lots of, you know, peculiar mental deficits.
Peter Tuohy, what about it? John Lehrer has boredom as kind of the golden gate here to the imagination, the way he sees it.
Yeah, I think golden gate's the word, isn't it? That the as Jonah's suggesting, it's a precursor or a reaction to boring circumstances. Makes perfect sense to me what he's saying. My one question is that when people daydream, is it all counterfactuals and working through information? How much wish fulfillment goes on in it? This is just a puzzle that's worried me.
But what's wrong with wish fulfillment? I don't know, dream of a better world or a better day.
Well, you think about 17-year-old boys, and it's not about a better world. I'll say no more, but
there's
still
be
an awful lot of... It may be. It may be illegal, too. But, to what extent, I guess this goes back to Freud and so on, but to what extent is boredom linked to wish fulfillment? That's my question. I don't know the answer, but I agree with the principle that daydream is definitely a reaction to boring circumstances.
We're talking about boredom. It's history, it's value, and whether or not we may need more of it these days. Let's get a call from Leah in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Leah. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
So
I really love this topic. I love the feeling of boredom, and especially boredom as it differs from depression.
Uh-huh.
And how important that is to know that there's a difference between depression and boredom, and we're pulled in so many directions all the time, you know, taking the kids to daycare, going to work, all these different things. It's nice when there's nothing, and time goes slower because you just have nothing to do.
So if it's luxurious and it feels great, is it boredom or is it something else, Leah?
I feel like it is boredom because it's not depression. And there's really, you almost want it to not be there, but it's enjoyable at the same time.
Yeah, that kind of untethered drift. I know how lovely that can feel. Leah, I really appreciate that call. Thank you for that. And may you have as much of it as you like. Mike in Hampton, Virginia, you're on, Mike.
Hi, yes, sir. I'm just wondering if boredom isn't maybe also tied or correlated somehow to culture, because back in the day when people were working from sunup to sundown, they didn't have a lot of time to experience or reflect on boredom. But, now that we have a lot of leisure time, boredom seems to be something that kind of has come along with that. I mean, and then to the other extreme, people of extreme wealth, you know, it doesn't seem like anything can satisfy them. Oh, I'm bored, you know. Doing this, I'm bored doing that. Everything is boring to them because they just can't be satisfied because they have everything and they have all this time.
Mike, I appreciate your call. Our time is short, but Peter Tuohy, do you think leisure, to the extent we have it, has given us more boredom?
Well, it seems to have been worse for those people in the 2nd century BC in Beneventum, I think, doesn't it?
Well, that one town, maybe that was just a boring town.
Well,
I don't know why. But, I mean, what do you think about a shepherd or somebody from those times? Were they more bored?
They say that hunter-gatherers, Australian ones, and probably those in the Kalahari, managed to do their work, their hunting and gathering, within 5 hours on each day. The rest of the time is empty time.
But maybe they were doing cave paintings or playing, I don't know, tiddlywinks.
I don't know. I mean, it's empty time, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll never know how they felt, but it's... I think it's too easy to say it's different for us now, and we were less bored when I was a boy. We all say that. I think we get used to technologies very quickly. If boredom is an emotion, it's something that's a constant. It's always lurking there in human lives, and it'll assert itself in the oddest of circumstances.
Jonah, make a big observation for us here. If we have more... busy time now, just the pace of month. If we do, and Peter says maybe we don't, but if we do, is there evidence that we're less imaginative these days with less time to daydream?
I think there's some tantalizing evidence. It's very early and very preliminary to say, but I think there's some tantalizing evidence that this lack of daydreaming, this lack of being able to kind of let ourselves go, is actually interfering with creativity and innovation, and, you know, perhaps even hurting the imagination too. You know, I just think a larger point is we live in a culture that so valorizes the tension. We assume that the way to be productive is to, you know, drink a big coffee, you know, and stare at the work, stare at our computer screen, you know, just focus, focus, focus. And sometimes focus is great. Sometimes being able to pay attention for long stretches is exactly what we need to do. But sometimes we need to take a long walk and let ourselves daydream, that the best idea you're ever going to have is going to come when you're in the shower. It's not going to come when you're at your desk. We have to do a better job of realizing that attention isn't the solution to every problem. Sometimes we need to be a little bit bored. Sometimes we need to find a space to relax in, to let our mind go. That is when the best idea is going to arrive.
There's a good piece of advice as summer comes to us. Joan Allaire, author of How We Decide, and Proust was a neuroscientist. Thank you so much for joining us from L.A. today, Jonah.
Thank you.
Peter Tuohy, do you share the advice? You know, go for a little boredom?
I think he's dead on when he says attention's not the solution. That's for sure. Too much focusing is harmful. I think one of the things we haven't touched on with boredom and creativity is a much simpler one too, is that boredom makes you unsettled with what's accepted.
That
and
may be
that
a good
sense,
thing as
produces,
well. Maybe produce
it
a little change.
Scientists.
A little change when we need it. Peter Tuohy, the University of Calgary. The new book is Boredom, A Lively History. Not boring at all. Thank you very much for being with us today, Professor Tuohy.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll go out with that Bruno Mars guy and his latest, The Lazy Song. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Don't be bored. Or if you do, if you are, enjoy it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I just want